Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bounds. It's a musical bonanza on the show today as we go from Bamako to Brazil and all the places in between for this week's album releases and music charts around the world. I'll be joined in the studio by the chief rock and pop critic for The Times, Will Hodgkinson, and the film critic Jason Solomons, who's also riffing on our melodic theme with a new documentary about the late Whitney Houston. And later on in the show, we'll be speaking to country superstar Steve Earle about his new record. Elsewhere on the programme, we'll find out what went down at this year's Tony Awards, and we'll have this week's Global Countdown too. It's music to our ears. It's all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bounds. Will and Jason, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I think we should play a little clip of Nick Broomfield's new film about Whitney Houston.
Can I
get us in the mood? Can I be me?
Whitney Houston actually died from a broken heart.
You gotta know who you are before you step into this business. You'll probably wind up being somebody that you don't even like.
If she were an artist today, she probably would still be here.
Well, it's pulling at the heartstrings just around the studio table here. Jason, this is new from Nick Broomfield. How kind of close to the bone does it go with
given that it's Nick Broomfield, you would expect it to go very close to the bone. You'd expect him in his white T-shirt and Fruit of the Loom T-shirt and Boom Mike to be
running around
in there probing, knocking on doors, saying, Mrs. Sissy Houston, what really happened?
Yeah.
He doesn't really do any of that. So you get quite a hagiographic kind of look at Whitney Houston. There's no doubt that this is an interesting story and an interesting icon who died, of course, in the Beverly Hilton bath. You get the pictures of her the most scuzzy bathroom ever award to Whitney Houston for that. The interesting kind of thing here is that Clive Davis at Arista tried to market a black diva for the white market. And that starts off Nick Broomfield asking some marketing executives at Arista how you would do that, which I think is fascinating. You know, we've got a whole kind of industry around this at the moment, what with the OJ, Oscar-winning OJ epic, which looked at OJ through the filter of racism in America. And I thought he was about to do that with Whitney. It doesn't happen, though. He gets kind of sidetracked by the concert footage from 1999 of that tour, which I saw Whitney Houston actually in Dublin on. But then I was wondering, she was going on this tour from, she was in Leipzig and Mannheim and Vienna. And I'm thinking,
all the great soul hotspots
of
the world.
I mean, you're minstreling yourself out there, kind of warbling away to a bunch of white people. And it felt very odd, but I mean, it's me making that assumption, not the Nick Broomfield film. And I thought that was very odd, given he isn't the only one to ask the hard questions. And he's a lot of his persona and reputation is from this kind of very conspicuous kind of awkward fellow, kind of walking around Biggie and Tupac's kind of battlegrounds going, excuse me, what happened? That's normally very funny. And in fact, people like Louis Theroux have probably sort of taken over. And John Ronson have probably taken the mantle over from Nick Broomfield on this. And so I thought he might be back doing this. He doesn't do that here. That said, it is still kind of like, oh, Whitney Houston, she was pretty good, really. Oh, God. I don't mind humming along to How Will I Know.
So is it that thing then? Is it the kind of thing that makes you kind of, you're straight onto YouTube for that great concert footage, you're straight into Spotify for the back catalogue? Is that what it's
you're
like?
You're certainly going, oh, what are my top 10 Whitney Houston records? And maybe I didn't know I had any. Well, one thing I didn't know, and Will may know this, of course, as chief music critic, is that Kevin Costner said to her, or said to the producer of I Will Always Love You, that she should do the first verse a cappella, no instrumental at all. And they thought, oh, that's mad. No, you're not going to have a number one single if you start with a cappella. And it was Kevin Costner, apparently, in perhaps the best thing he's ever done, is advising Whitney Houston to just go a cappella on that. And I never knew this. That came out in
that's good facts. So Nick Broomfield's uncovered some fresh
exactly,
material.
It's a little bit pop quiz fact from Nick
Broomfield. Yeah, it's good.
Listen, I found that some of the interviews moving, of course, but there's this kind of, how much expertise does your sax player and your backing singer and your pianist from that band in the 1990s tour, how much do they really know when they're sort of saying, oh yes, it was the drugs that got her, oh, she died of a broken heart because of Bobby. They don't really know, and the film doesn't get under that skin. And given that it starts off being a film about skin, I feel that it's a sort of missed opportunity. And the title Can I Be Me is something that Whitney would sort of say because she didn't want to be modelled into this kind of white pop princess. Can I Be Me? And they used to tease her about it, but Mike Yarwood used to sort of say, and this is me, you know, the real Whitney Houston, please stand up. I'm not sure she does here, but then by the end, I think she's pretty much doing her own material, and she's doing gospel riffs and in big stadium concert and singing Joy, which is from the, of course, she was in the Waiting to Exhale and the Preacher's Wife and those soundtracks. There's a great artist in here, but we never get to see it flourish. The odd thing is that there is another Whitney Houston doc on its way from Kevin MacDonald and produced by Simon Chin. Okay. And this one's getting the attention of the Nick Broomfield one, A, because it's Nick Broomfield, and B, because it's first. They've rushed it out, and I don't quite know why. And it sort of ends peremptorily, given that there is a sort of beginning, middle, and an end for this story. This doc ends and you're like, what? Is it over? And given that one of Rick Whitney's kind of refrains is, the record ain't over yet, I got a feeling that
that's
over
sort of
yet.
Echoing outro of
exactly.
The whole film.
See what I did there?
So it's Whitney, Can I Be Me? It's out in cinemas today, in fact.
What's your favourite Whitney Houston track?
I think it would have to be off that first Whitney album. It's got to be I Want to Dance with Somebody. I mean, it's just the obvious one, but it's great. I think I completely fell in love with her just off the album cover of that.
Well, it's the back on the back when she's in the swimsuit. Yeah. I mean, she looked absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Saving All My Love is going to be, it's a time when I was 17 and I heard that, I thought this is the worst thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
Yeah.
And now I love it.
Yeah, but then when Laura Mendel asked me to dance with her to it, I realised what it was all about. That's what a sax solo's for, I thought to myself.
This is the knitting together the playlist, right?
Yeah, but I also found that Nick didn't mean. You'd wait for the music credits in any music dot. You kind of think, oh, I'm going to take my gun down. Yeah. There's about six, and I thought, right, well, I'd got all those down
all those.
Anyway.
Then
they're all there for sure.
Yeah.
So slightly odd, I thought, and slightly missing stuff. But yet, what was there is sad to witness, of course.
Okay, we're going to stay in real life, but the fictionalising of it. This is Churchill, another Churchill on screen. So let's take a clip. This is new. This is Brian Cox as Churchill.
I am the Prime Minister of this country, and I shall not be stopped from speaking my mind.
You can't just change everything over the heads of our allies.
Don't assume you're the only one capable of making decisions.
I need your help.
Try acting like a hero, Winston, and then maybe people will believe that you are one.
Men will die.
That's enough! My fiancé is on one of those ships. I'm sorry, I have no right.
You have every right.
He's not the man he was. He could be a liability as a leader.
Would you have us do nothing with the Nazis massing 20 miles off our shores?
No! I would have us do more!
Saving all my cigars for somebody there. Brian Cox as Churchill. In a long and rich tradition of screen Churchills, where does Brian Cox sit? Where's this?
Yeah, he's probably
sit?
The most Scottish of them. I'll give him that.
You'll give him that. Okay. We've had some Irish ones.
We've had some American ones. Robert Hardy was English, I think.
Yeah,
For me, it's always Robert Hardy, the Churchill.
Yeah.
But we've got Gary Oldman coming up soon in Joe Wright's The Darkest Hour. Like Whitney Houston vehicles, you wait 20 years for them and two turn up.
Exactly.
Same with Churchills. Brian Cox is a good Churchill. I tell you what he gets very well is the gait, the physicality of him. I think he sort of says, well, I'm not going to draw a tractor like that because that's, you know, I'm Hannibal Lecter and I can do that voice. I'll do that one instead. So he chomps on his cigars, but he gets the feet right and the movement right. And look, I don't know how Churchill really moved. The point is that he looks like someone who might have been the put upon rather drunken Prime Minister of Great Britain through the war, had just come through the Blitz and is about to now kind of wrestle with the D-Day problem. And this is what the film is about. It's kind of the three days before they launch, you know, the Norman invasion.
It's about doubt, all that stuff.
The whole thing is that he was at Gallipoli in the First World War, which was a disaster. So he has the kind of images of the 56,000 British and Anzac troops who were slaughtered that day through an ill-advised kind of beach invasion. He doesn't want it to happen again. And then he goes to Ike Eisenhower and Monty Montgomery and sort of says, no, I don't want it to happen.
They first, go, you're on first in terms of those
all
guys?
All of them.
Wow.
War, entertainment,
world leaders. Historical first name terms.
I'm like Zelig. Yeah.
I love it.
I just insert myself. And so he worries about that. And they sort of say, well, come on, we're all a mass. We're about ready to go. And he goes, oh, it's not going to be good. And I don't know if this was true. The script is written by Alex von Tinselman, who is a sort of colleague of mine at The Guardian when I was there. She writes sort of historical reports on movies and sort of say, are they historically accurate? And Marks have actually written a whole book about this. Irony is now she gets to do her historical movie. And of course, she suddenly gets confronted with the thing that all scriptwriters are confronted with, is that the facts are rather dull unless you kind of telescope them, put together, sex them up a bit and put all things together. And she's done all that here. I mean, he did have doubts about the Norman invasion, but like months before, not like the day before. So she kind of plays with what Peter Morgan used to do, does so well, that kind of Shakespearean grandiloquence of the interior monologue. I'm gonna have a long dark night of the soul. I'm gonna get really drunk, and Clem is gonna have to burst in and sort of say, "Oh, Winston, you are a card, aren't you?" Just as that, you know, we are about at war. Yeah. So it's all of that, and you try and get that interior. It just never comes together in any great kind of way that what you get from Peter Morgan, you don't get here from Jonathan Teplitzky, and you get a rather dull kind of procession of people talking in airless rooms. Like it's very, very two shot.
It's very roomy.
Two shot, and then they try and open it up with a bit of a beach here or a monument there. It's shot in Scotland, which he says at the start, Creative Scotland. You think, oh, that's great, and then you think London. I mean, I've lived in London all my life. It doesn't really look like that. And then you think, well, that I know that monument. It's in Scotland, and so they do a lot of this kind of, I don't quite know why.
Well, pretend London.
London, but also those columns that are in the park in Edinburgh. They use those a lot, and you're like, but that, why are they there? That's a kind of well known monument. These Doric kind of columns. I mean, I know it's Edinburgh. So what's he doing in Edinburgh? It sort of doesn't make any sense, and I'm wondering who it's for. Miranda Richardson is quite good as Clemmy, but she's just
That's another one. That can be even one dimensional thing. It's the cardboard cutout wife of Churchill.
Yeah.
You know, a woman with strong opinions. A very straight backbone, stronger than Winston's, possibly, if not metaphorically. How does she fare in it?
She does as well as she can with a very thankless role. And again, given that this was written by a woman, I would have thought that would have been the key role. It remains to be seen what Kristin Scott Thomas does it opposite Gary Oldman in Joe Wright's film, which is coming out sort of November, December time. You'd have thought a bit more for Miranda Richardson to do in this. I mean, all she does is sort of pick him up off the floor, tell him to stop drinking a bit more and get on writing his speech. And then there's a secretary that comes along who he bawls out occasionally. I found it very, you know, it could have done with a bit more honesty in its parody and pastiche, because it's done that, but tried to be very serious about them. So there's no laughs in it. And yet, really, I think it would have been warmer had it been played for laughs. So maybe the script's all right and it needed a director to just come and be a bit more mischievous with it. As it is, you get a really kind of somber piece that is kind of sort of suggests that England was under the reign of a kind of drunk sort of baby. I mean, you'd almost think Trump should have a look at this, because this is what it might be like. This is what it might be like in Florida
on
the weekends.
Note to self.
Yeah, exactly. But I didn't see the point of it really. This point film it's unilluminating.
And do we go to the beaches? Do we get that at the end?
No, don't even get the big, you know, Saving Private Ryan payoff with the slaughter. No, you get nothing from that. I mean, you get the postscript saying, "Oh, Britain invaded and we won the war, and Churchill was voted the greatest Briton," and you're like, well,
spoiler alert.
And he's also, you know, capable of flaws. I mean, come on, tell me something a little bit cleverer than that. I really wanted that. And by the end, I was pretty frustrated with this movie. And I was wishing it was about the talking dog who does insurance, that kind of Churchill.
Voiced by Rick Reed.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It would have been much
What could possibly go wrong? Winston Churchill as to quote Jason Solomon's, a drunk baby. It's good. It's good. I think everyone knows exactly what you mean. So it's good. So you can catch Churchill if you'd like to at cinemas now. Now, last weekend over on Broadway, the Tony Awards took place. One of the most prestigious prizes in theatre, if not the most. Our regular contributor and critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe, was there. And he walked through some of the winners and losers with Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
The Tony Awards, which were a couple of nights ago at Radio City Music Hall, are basically, you know, they're there to be an advertisement for Broadway. They're, you know, designed to sell tickets and have a parade of celebrities, some big musical numbers, and a really exciting host. And I think it's interesting this year that the Tonys had a hard act to follow, because last year was all about Hamilton. And in fact, last year the Tonys were called the Hamiltonys. But this year there wasn't like one show that dominated the way Hamilton did. So the awards were reasonably generally spread. The big winner was a show called Dear Evan Hansen, which I liked very much, which is a musical, an original musical that's really getting a lot of attention. It's got an advance sale upwards of $40 million, and it's not based on a movie. It's not based on anything else. It's entirely fresh, and it has this 23-year-old leading man in it named Ben Platt, who's been like the sensation of the New York theater season. And everything surrounding Dear Evan Hansen at the Tonys was very, very exciting, but not everything was as exciting.
Like the Kevin host, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Kevin Spacey was the host, and, you know, I love Kevin Spacey. He's won two Oscars. He's won a Tony himself for Lost in Yonkers. He began in the New York theater, so he's a real theater guy. Of course, he lived in London for many years at the Old Vic, but he made a big thing in his hosting routine about how he wasn't the first choice to host the Tonys. There had been other people who had turned it down, and he made a big thing about this, which was a little bit awkward, because I think when you're watching any award ceremony, you don't really want the host telling you, well, you know, I wasn't really who they wanted, but they had to settle for me because they couldn't get the other person. So that was weird. And he also does these impressions. You know, he's famous for doing impressions. So he did impressions of people like Johnny Carson, who was a famous talk show host of another era. I mean, long, long since passed away. Bill Clinton, of course, who, you know, great Bill Clinton, but he's not exactly somebody of the moment. And all the impressions seemed a little bit forced. So that was kind of strange. I think everyone was pining for some of the great hosts of previous years, like Hugh Jackman or Neil Patrick Harris, people like that.
What a disappointment. What about, tell us about the other winners, perhaps like Bette Midler?
Well, the big star power on Broadway this year has been Bette Midler returning to the musical theater. She's done a play in New York a few years ago, but returning to the musical theater for the first time in about 50 years on Broadway, playing Dolly Gallagher-Levi in the musical Hello, Dolly. It's been a sensation. Good tickets are going for thousands of dollars. And it was pretty much guaranteed that she would win Best Actress in a Musical. And the fact of the matter was, everyone wanted Bette to win because they love her, but they also wanted her to give a great speech. And boy, oh boy, did she give a great speech. One of the things about Bette is she will not be drowned out by the music. You know, if you talk too long, they play music, and then you have to shut up. But she would not be silenced. And she was shouting over the music, and she told whoever was in charge of the music to shut that crap off. And then she just kept right on going. And then finally the music stopped, and she just kept continuing and continuing and continuing. And of course, everyone loves somebody with a bit of nerve and a bit of chutzpah. So she absolutely brought down the house.
I have a suggestion, perhaps, Bette, as a host next year.
Well, you know, it's really funny you say that, because I think that has crossed a lot of people's minds. Bette makes a big fuss about the fact that she's 71 and she's not as young as she used to be and her stamina isn't great. But she's finishing in Hello, Dolly in January of 2018, and next year's Tonys aren't until June, so she'll have 4 or 5 months to rest up. I think she should definitely do it.
Matt Wolf there on this year's Tony Awards, and you're listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bounds. And I'm in the studio with the rock and pop critic for The Times, Will Hodgkinson, and the film critic, Jason Solomons, who's been talking us through this week at the cinema. We'll turn to you now, Will, for some music. We're going to kick off with the Fleet Foxes. Welcome back, the Fleet Foxes. Is that what we're saying?
After a long time away.
Yeah. A hiatus of God knows how long.
6 years.
Yeah, there's been plenty of head scratching in that time.
It's been beyond that. I mean, we can talk about, well, should we hear the song? To hear a touch, and then I'll tell the strange story of Fleet Foxes.
Well, I like that. Okay, yeah, let's not spoil it. Let's have a bit of, this is Kept Woman. It's from the new album from Fleet Foxes called Crack Up.
Can you be slow for a little while? Widder your soul for another mile. I'm just the same as when you saw me back then, and we're bound to be reconciled.
A bit of Wind and Wuthering there. Kept Woman from the new album from Fleet Foxes, which is called Crack Up. Yeah, talk us through this one, Will.
Well, the story really is the story of Robin Pecknold, who's the singer, the creative guy behind the whole thing. And the album is called The Crack Up, the reason being that he really did crack up. It's named after F. Scott Fitzgerald's short stories, but it's really about what happened to him. He never wanted this bizarre thing. Essentially, Fleet Foxes was, he went on holiday to the Lake District when he was about 19 or 20. He discovered English folk music. He heard Anne Briggs and Steel I Span, and he loved it. And he thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to do something like that? Thinking he'd do something for a handful of people. He made an album on two or three maxed out credit cards. The album got picked up. He put a few tracks on MySpace. The album got picked up by a label called Belly Union. At this point, still nobody thought that sort of rather monastic English folk sung by an American would go anywhere. It became one of the biggest albums of 2008. And he freaked out. He formed this band. But then suddenly he was headlining the other stage at Glastonbury, whereas, you know, a few weeks before, he was playing in front of a handful of people in Seattle. So the experience of being in a very successful band is what everyone thinks they want. But when you have a shy, very self-effacing, very quite interior and quite damaged person, it wasn't really what he wanted. And he made another album, which wasn't as good as the first, and then he disappeared. He enrolled as a student at Columbia University. And, you know, you've got to remember, by this point, Fleet Foxes were a household name. He was incognito, went surfing every day up in upstate New York, went running for sort of 2 hours a day, and studied English literature, and thought that was it. He's never coming back. But somehow the pull of, it's not, I wouldn't exactly call it rock and roll, but, you know, the pull of monastic folk got the better of him.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's made this amazing album. I mean, it's really, really complex. It's quite a difficult listen. That's the easiest song on it.
That sounds like something from that debut album.
That sounds like Fleet Foxes, yeah. But most of it doesn't. It jumps around all over the place. Lots of songs have, you know, they're two different things going on at once. And actually, this is might interest you, Jason. He based it on Nick Roeg. Because, you know, Nick Roeg would do this intercut scenes which were contrasting. Yeah. You know, you watch Walkabout and or Don't Look Now or any of those films, and you have these kind of very clashing scenes. And that's what he wanted to do with the music. So you do have that very beautiful autumnal, rather kind of, you know, harmony-rich music, and then suddenly something very atonal will come in. So it's a difficult listen. It's quite a long album, but I think it's fantastic. And it's, yeah, he's come back and they're actually playing Latitude, and I think they're going to do an hour and a half set of just their new album, which is going to drive everyone completely insane.
Please play the new stuff.
Exactly.
That's what we all yell.
Yeah. It's real Neil Young territory. I mean, it's you know, there's going to be no sing-alongs.
And you do that still with Fleet Foxes rather than doing that just as a solo album or calling yourself
thing.
Something else. Because that's always an interesting thing, what you do as a solo record, what you do as a band record.
Well, he did some very minor... So he did some low-key gigs as a solo guy, supporting Joanna Newsom. You know, Fleet Foxes are a much bigger band, much bigger draw than Joanna Newsom is. And so he's coming on stage and just, you know, with a little acoustic guitar and, you know, playing for 20 minutes or something. He did a tribute band to... I've forgotten who it was now. He did a tribute... Oh, that's right, to Gene Clark, who was a member of the Byrds briefly. Yeah. So he did these kind of low-key things, but he's been beavering away... when he hasn't been surfing and studying.
Has the studies, the English literature, whatever it is that he studied, have they kind of bled into the music? Is this now more literary references than he had before as a teenager? Or?
There's some literary references. I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, it's very, very hard to work out what the songs are about. But if you listen to the music, it's very easy to understand what the songs are about. They're about a crack-up. They're about someone having a nervous breakdown and trying to rebuild their life. And you kind of feel it across the album. I don't know. I mean, I think probably it's soaked into it. I did an interview with him not long ago, and I asked him that question. And he gave a fairly evasive answer, saying, "I'm definitely from the school of show, don't tell." And I think it's just impressionistic music. So, yeah, I think it probably does. But certainly not in any kind of narrative way.
Mm. Well, it sounds like it was good to write about as well. I mean, that's always the thing when you have a record that maybe is a difficult listen, but it's a pleasure to write about. There's something in that.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
And also, so a pleasure to meet someone like that who's got something to say, who's the opposite of the usual singer type.
Okay, well, it's called Crack Up. It's by Fleet Foxes, and it is out today. Finally, Will, let's have a listen to let's have a cut of the new record by Songhoi Blues. It's a little bit more leery and scary in a good way. Great stuff. Oh, they've got an interesting story as well. And in fact, before we turn on the microphones, you and Jason were talking about the film that kind of launched them.
That's
many
right.
Ways. Yeah.
They're sort of the opposite of Fleet Foxes. You know, Fleet Foxes are nice middle-class boys who are tortured.
These guys didn't come to the Lake District and listen to some Steel Eye Span records, did they?
You know
the sound of it.
I mean, maybe they have done since then and they've discovered the delights of Fairport Convention while they're at it. But
well,
I mean,
reminds me of Sandy Denny.
Who knows, yeah. Exactly. But no, they came from the desert in northern Mali, and there was a jihadist uprising, which everyone will have read about, with Ansar Dine, who imposed this Sharia law, the most extreme version. So they're banned from making music. I mean, people were having their hands chopped off. It was horrific. So they had no choice. They had to get out. They met, they formed in Bamako, and they're combining, I mean, a lot of it's rock music. You know, there's a lot of, you know, electric guitars buzzing through that. But it's this tradition of desert blues, which you've always had in Mali, which is Ali Fakatore, who's the great desert blues guitarist. And that's the combination, and it's celebratory, joyous music. And I also, something that struck me is the time I interviewed them was in this little club in Paris, and they're talking about all this stuff. And then they did the gig, and the gig was fantastic. It was very interesting crowd, very African, very upbeat, really good fun in the way, in that kind of French-African way, where everyone's just up for a good time. The following day, next door was the Bataclan massacre. And I was thinking, for these guys, music really is a matter of life and death. You know, they've escaped this, and then it's following them around. And they, you know, the first album's called Music in Exile. They're essentially an exiled band. I mean, they're essentially on tour now. And don't really, I think they live in Paris now as much as they can.
Yeah.
But you know, they can hardly go home.
Because it was a documentary that that first discovered. I think they even played in Cannes about 3 or 4 years ago.
Right. Well,
I can't remember the name of the title.
They're going to have to kill us first.
Exactly. And it was a protest movie. It was like, let's carry on playing while, you know.
But that's the whole thing. And that's what's very, very life affirming about the music. You know, it's great fun music. There's not really, even the ballads on the album are very kind of upbeat somehow, you know, they make you feel good. These guys are making music as a protest against what they've escaped from, and so it's going to be fun, you know, it's going to be celebratory, and it's, you know, it's about having a party and dancing. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a really good fun album. It's not the, you know, as much as I can understand the lyrics, they're pretty simple, fairly straightforward.
Saturday night in Bamako, let's go. Saturday night in Timbuktu.
Yeah. That's what that song is about.
So good.
Yeah.
And they're always so good live.
Brilliant live.
This is the kind of thing when they come, because these people are often on at festivals just as it's kind of getting dark. It's that kind of lull, actually. It's the five to 6 to 7 o'clocky kind of at the time when everyone needs a pick-me-up.
But everyone talks
amazing.
About it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. And what's great about them also is that Africa doesn't have a tradition of bands. It has a tradition of singers, stars, with musicians playing behind them. And the first time I saw them, I thought, wow, they actually kind of look like the Specials. You know, they're all dressed in these, in, you know, three-button shirts and smart, you know, kind of like a bit moddy almost.
Yeah.
You know, and they weren't...
tie like piano keys.
Yeah, no, they have a sense of style which you perhaps wouldn't...
associate. Yeah, they are unusual. They're great fun. They're definitely up for a good time. And they make this music, which is kind of, in its own way, it's profound. But I just love the fact that it's so much fun.
Yeah, it's pretty funky. I mean, it always reminds me slightly of the Rumble in the Jungle kind of
the
James Brown groove that was going
on. James Brown as well, yeah. It's got a big James Brown influence.
Yeah,
you can hear that on the one beat, you know.
And there's something strange when you have an album and there is something repetitive about about this stuff. But you listen to a 12-track record, and I've loved this song. I love this album and reviewed it for the magazine. It's one of those funny things you keep on having on repeat. You think these rhythms are going to get... They're nagging rhythms, which is great because you want to dance to them. You want to tap along to it while you're writing. But you realise you've listened to that record 5 times in a day. And that's an amazing... That's an unusual thing.
There's also an element of silliness. I mean, Iggy Pop comes along and he does this...
He's good on that, isn't he?
He's funny. He starts talking about how you can't get a pizza in the desert.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, well, yeah, maybe you can. I don't know. I haven't been there. But, you know, it's kind of ridiculous.
Is Damon Albarn on there at all?
No, Damon Albarn.
He must be upset there.
He's been snubbed.
Contractually obliged to be on every album from
Northern
Africa.
There's a kind of... There's sort of people that always turn up, and I like the fact that they're not there. Iggy Pop's not typical of that world. Elf Kid, who's a 20-year-old rapper from Lewisham, is on there. They're the only two guests. So you've got Elf Kid on one side, Iggy Pop on the other, and four guys from Northern Mali making this great, I'd say, a rock and roll album. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a rock and roll album. It's about escapism. There's no moralising.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing earnest about it, and it's a laugh.
Are they playing here in the UK?
Yeah, they're playing. You should go and see them. They're definitely doing the festivals, and they always, you know, they're always the band that everyone goes away and talks about. And they're doing dates. I can't roll them off the top of my head.
Yeah, I know, you're not a walking timeout. I know. Where's that film on? Yeah. Oh, I know, 5:20. I don't know.
Yeah. It's not the Swiss Cottage Ocean, don't worry. We can point people towards the Google section of the internet for that. Resistance by Songhai Blues is out today on Transgressive Records. Thank you very much, Will Hodgkinson, for your music reviews today. Will and Jason are going to be sticking around for a bit longer when we have this week's Global Countdown. But first, we're going to hear from the country music legend Steve Earle. The multi-Grammy award-winning musician has released over a dozen albums since his breakthrough in 1986 with Guitar Town, and this week he's putting out his latest, So You Wanna Be an Outlaw. He speaks to Andrew Muller about making the record and everyone's favourite topic right now, American politics.
So you wanna be an outlaw, but take it from me. It's living on the highway ain't everything's supposed to be. Everybody reckons that they wanna be free.
I mean, I never recorded in Texas before, oddly enough. I mean, not a record. I made a few recordings there before I left there and went to Tennessee. But, you know, it was not so much as a return to Guitar Town as a prequel to Guitar Town, because Guitar Town was made in 1986, and I'd been in Nashville 13 years, and I myself was having trouble where I came from and the point at which I came in, because I got to Nashville in 1974, and you could walk into JJ's Market, and Waylon and Tom Paul Glazer would be in there banging on those pinball machines in the middle of the night when they were off the road, and, you know, it was very democratic and very, very open and great place to learn how to write songs, and I had good teachers, and so it's about that moment, and, you know, a lot of it was just, you know, I'd written a blues record, and I was finishing those songs and writing songs with Sean Colvin for our record together, and those were a certain type of song, and then T-Bone Burnett asked me to write a song for the TV show Nashville, and it was about, you know, this guy had a brother who was in prison, and I wrote If Mama Could Have Seen Me for that, and then I've been listening to Honky Tonk Heroes a lot, which mm-hmm. was a Waylon Jennings record that was made in 72. And that kind of started a thing going. And not too long after that, Buddy Miller took over as a musical director. He asked me to write another song. And I wrote Looking for a Woman for Buddy for the show.
This is the single from the album.
Yeah, it's the single from the album now. And I just realized, well, these are country songs. I mean, they're archaic country songs, I guess. But so maybe this is where it's going. And what was different was, it's a country record, and I guess an archaic one because country music's changed a lot. But it's also a very electric record, the most electric record I've made in a long time.
So was there a particular point at which you started hearing those big twanging Bakersfield Telecasters? There are a lot of, whether intentional or not, at least that's how it sounded to me, references to Guitar Town and Exit O. And, of course, you just come off the back of the 30th anniversary tour of Guitar Town.
Some of these songs we routined while on sound checks, you know, before, which is always an advantage when you're getting ready to make a record and you want to make it, you know, live with the band. So it does, you know, there's a nod to that. Richard Bennett produced it, who was the guitar player on Guitar Town and Exit Zero. And I asked him to produce it, not because of that. I asked him because he's from Phoenix, and he was there when Waylon Jennings was in Scottsdale playing clubs and sat in with him when he was a teenager. And I knew he would understand what I was trying to do. That was based on, I was channeling Waylon Jennings as much as I possibly could.
The idea of a 4th of July picnic this year cues up the fairly obvious question about celebrating America's National Day. It will be the first 4th of July of the Donald Trump era, should his presidency last that long. How difficult has it been to restrain yourself from writing an entire concept album about presently occurring?
Right. We recorded this in December. We started recording on December, 5th or something like that. And I don't know. It's, you know, I thought about it. We knew the outcome of the election. We were actually in Canada when Trump was elected doing the Guitar Town 30th anniversary tour. And it was a two-set show because we did Guitar Town, and then we came back, mm-hmm. took an intermission, came back out and played. And, you know, so we knew when we went on for the second set that things weren't looking good. And I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, and that wasn't my favorite situation, but I knew what that was. We'd had it before. And I, you know, so I thought, okay, well, I'm just making this record, and this record's about me and where I come from. And I thought about altering it for political content, but then I said, no, I'm going to put this out. And I've got this record's the countryest thing I've done in a long time, and it sort of feels like a place I'm going to linger for a while musically. You know, maybe for a long time. I like this band and this version of the band, and I like playing this stuff. I've sort of changed my approach to electric guitar a lot, and I'm a better guitar player than I was, you know, when I made Guitar Town, a lot better guitar player. So this record, my guitar's mixed up stupid loud, and everybody kept saying, you sure you want your guitar that loud? Yeah, it's my record, and I want the guitar that loud. But I don't know. It's just that the next record is going to be probably just as country as this one, but way more political. You can pretty much count on it.
Working with as any kind of politically engaged artist and as an activist as well, both of which you've done, that's all essentially, I think, when you boil down an act of optimism. You're making this effort because
I'm believe 62 it's worthwhile. And I have a 7-year-old son. I'm an optimist. I'm not anything else. So.
But what has happened hasn't dented that at all?
No, I think that what happens is what we're going to have to do, and maybe in the process of this record, I'll have to examine it, this next record. It's not just about what I believe and what I think's good for working people. It's also we lost touch with working people, and we forgot that they really are out there. And you can say eat your peas all you want to, but the truth of the matter is, coal miners in West Virginia voted for Donald Trump. And I know some of those people because I'm working on a theater piece that I'm just doing music for. Other people are writing it. That's about a coal mining disaster that happened in West Virginia. And I knew they were all going to vote for Trump. But people in Michigan that don't have jobs voted for him too. And they really did believe him when he said that he was going to provide, that the problem was he managed to convince these people that everything wrong in their lives was being caused by the other, those other people that don't look like you and don't talk like you that are coming from the outside.
It's an old but effective trick. I want to move along somewhat to another project that you've been working on for a while. What would you describe it as, a songwriting workshop?
Yeah, it's a songwriting camp. It's 3 days. You know, there are people there that are never going to be professional songwriters. There are people we've found a few people along the way. A really great little songwriter called Roseanne Reed showed up at our first one, and she came in a scholarship the second year, and now the last year and this year she comes in and works with us there, helps us with the curriculum. Bernard Shaw was a really smart guy, but he said one of the most ignorant things anybody's ever said, and that was those that can do and those that can't teach. Because, I mean, you know, I have people come in that are interested in kinds of music that I don't listen to, and I like the idea of teaching makes me have to go back, and I do this almost in my sleep, and it makes me go back and examine, yeah, well, how did I do that? How did I arrive at that?
This is what I was wondering. Having written songs for so long, and clearly you're good at it, that sounds like damning with faint praise, but it's, on the one hand, writing a song is a fairly easy thing to do. You can learn four chords and you can learn which lines rhyme.
Yeah, everybody should try to do it.
But it's very hard to write a song that anyone's going to care about half an hour from now, never mind decades and decades from now. So I'm just wondering, how much of it do you think can actually be taught? What's the ratio between craft and art?
I can teach the mechanics of it. I can teach how I go about it. And you'll write better songs than you did before if you absorb that. And I can teach you the intellectually what the essence of it is, as far as I know and as far as I believe. And to me, the essence of songwriting or any art that finds an audience is empathy. I don't go the Andy Kaufman route. I don't believe just because something resonates with me that it resonates with everybody. You know, and I don't think I'm that smart. I don't think I'm that cool, but I'm glad I practice an art form where I take it out. Guy Clark said something to me a long time ago, and we lost him this year, but he said, songs aren't finished until you play them for people. Because we're singer-songwriters. That's who we are. We're post-Bob Dylan songwriters. All of us were in Nashville being staff writers under false pretenses. We all really wanted a record deal, wanted to record our own songs. We're always honored when somebody else sings your song. And when a great singer sings your song, it makes you feel, you know, 100 feet tall. But I want to write songs and go out and play them for people and immediately know whether they're connecting with it or not.
Can you come around and make a mess? Can you promise not to stray again? And I always took you back and then you broke my heart.
Steve Earle's new album, So You Wanna Be an Outlaw, is out now. Now, before we leave today, it's time for our global countdown when we take a look at the music charts of another country. And of course, who's going to do that but Fernando Augusto Pacheco on home turf. Fernando, today we're in Brazil.
Welcome. Can you believe it? We haven't done Brazil yet.
I thought you're hiding your light under a bushel. I thought you'd have come out with those in the first program, but no.
But we discussed this actually, Rob, about a year ago, that I was saying that how in Brazil, Brazilians love country music, you know? So
yeah.
So basically the whole of top 10 in Brazil is country music, basically. But in the country music genre, you can divide. So for example, in the top 5, we have feminist country, university country, and tropical house country. So
man, I love these genres.
It's subdivided in a lot of categories. Shall we start with number 5?
Let's do it.
By the way, the main theme is about cheating. I mean, I think
okay.
4 out of the 5 songs talks about cheating as well. But number 5, actually, it's an interesting, Marília Mendonça. We discussed about her, Rob, about a year ago. I don't know if you remember.
I know her name. Yeah, this is great. I just remember loving this, yeah.
The song is called Amante Não Tem Lar, or A Lover Doesn't Have a Home. And what I like about this song is basically, in the song, you know, she is the cheat. And actually, she's talking to another woman. She's like, you know, I've cheated, I'm sorry, I know that I've basically destroyed your life, but you know what, I couldn't control myself. And that's the trend, because her album's basically...
I've got that as a pre-sent text message, just in case.
No, and it's nice that she's, you know, she's talking to another woman. And basically, her whole album, she says, you know, that I care about my female fans. And she says, I'm a feminist, and, you know, I'm not ashamed of saying that as well, which is quite relevant in Brazil, especially in the macho world of country music.
So I like that. So when you flag this up, you said, There's a few key genres. So that's feminist country.
Feminist country.
What's number 4?
More feminist country, if you don't mind. It's Maiara and Maraisa with Sorte Que Se Beija Bem, which is you're lucky that you kiss very well, actually. So basically they're saying, you know, I'm only with you because you have amazing kisses.
A bit of feminist country pop. Okay. So that was Maiara and Maraisa.
Exactly. Good.
Sorry. Really bad, isn't it? People are going to write in. They have before. Gustavo Lima. We're okay with him. I think we're on. But what genre is he?
Yeah. Well, Gustavo Lima is an interesting. Again, it's country, but country pop, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, and he's one of the few Brazilian artists that made abroad, actually. So he was in the European charts with a song called Che-re-re-re, which is, it doesn't mean anything, it's just like a sound noise, like blah 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 blah, something like that. And you know, I think he reached the top 5 in Germany, he was successful in France, so but now I think he's back to Brazil, and the song is Abre o Portão Que Eu Cheguei, which means open the gates, I've arrived. And again,
is that a metaphor? Sounds a bit like it might be rude.
Well, I think he's a bit angry because he said, you tell me it's love, but you're only with me for pleasure. Which is not a problem, but I think he's a bit
sad.
He's
getting used.
Yeah, this is more feminist.
It's just a toy.
Yeah. So the men are actually like being like, you're just moving for pleasure, I want love. And I don't know, it's a national problem, but I know that we love talking about, you know, cheating. We even have an expression, the sadness of a cheated man. It's very weird if I translate, but I think everybody knows.
How do you say that?
Dor de corno.
Doji corno.
Which is a man with horns.
Cuckold.
Exactly. Oh, do you have the same in English?
Not me personally, okay. But yes, I've heard.
It's just the way Jason's wearing his headphones.
Exactly. Number 2 is very interesting. That's a tropical house country. He's a very young guy, Luan Santana. And again, the country genre, which that's what he was kind of born into. They say, oh, he's not real country music. So he's kind of in between, because then the pop world don't accept him. But to be honest, I think he doesn't care, because he sells millions of copies and that's what matters. Personally, I don't like the song that much. It's called Waking Up My Building. So basically he's doing like a party on the residential block he lives. I mean, it's a bit weird, but you know, nice beats though.
Cheesy. It sounds cheesy. You know,
sounds cheesy for me.
Tropical house and country music sounds like it's got to be cheesy.
It's very cheesy, yeah.
Sounds like Cotton Eye Joe somehow to me.
Yeah.
So what's number 1, Faye, in Brazil?
More country. A very, you know, how do you say, traditional country, I would say, number 1, is Marcos and Belluti. They're a duo, and their last 4 singles were number 1, so I think they are the main duo in Brazil at the moment. Shall we listen to the number 1 song?
Yes, please. Okay, so that was Eu Era from Marcos and Belluti. That was that was very much in the territory of the single-handed power grab.
Exactly.
Thinking, right? That was.
Did they win Brazil's
out.
Got Talent?
No.
No.
I'm going to read a very lyric about this song, which is translating. It's called I Was. And again, it's men complaining about women. You know, he said, I was looking for a brief relief, but you just wanted to kiss 4 or 5 mouths. But you've kissed the wrong mouth, and now you're remembering the right mouth. It's weird.
Victimhood.
It's all right. It's good. I think that's a light as a loft. I mean, it's, you know, yeah. I think
you're glad you're in the UK, aren't you, Philip? Exactly. You treat you much nicer here. You don't want all that upset.
What do we think of that, Will? Come on, that's the.
It sounded to me like a kind of Drive Time. I can imagine, you know, driving through the interior in Brazil and that's blasting out. You know, I'd like the car to be an open top.
I
think it'd be fun. It's a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, it's definitely a guilty pleasure. Jason?
I know the last Brazilian duo I saw was Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil.
Which is wonderful.
That's very classy, though.
They used to be number one in the 70s.
Well, that's
the
what
80s.
I'm saying. So yeah. They were popular. It wasn't like they're like from the... Now it's classy, but they used to be popular. They were number one. And I'm thinking that it feels a little... I suppose the scene is fractured, as you say, which is more interesting than we're seeing from those.
And they don't release singles anymore, but their albums still sell pretty well, you know, when they release a new album.
I love that bit at the end of the show, and thank you for talking us through a territory that you know like no other, the hometown of Brazil. That was good stuff. Who is the last song again?
It's Marco Zambellucci, Eu Era.
I don't know if they deserve quite so many mentions.
Well, Will's already hired a car.
He's on the road. He's on Hertz. he's throwing his Sheryl Crow CDs out of the car and he's going all the way with Marcos and Bellucci. That brings us to the end of today's show. This programme was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I've been Robert Bound. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, let's play out with Marcos and Bellucci again with Eru Era. Thanks for tuning in. Beijou a boca errada, lembrou da boca certa. Entrou numa gelada, lembrou da minha coberta. Saber se alguém perfeito que você tanto espera. Eu era, aí você se lembra que a gente se completa. E vai voltar pra mim, se for um pouco esperta. Porque se alguém perfeito que você tanto espera.